Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We would like to welcome you now to this press briefing, which is organized by Executive Intelligence Review. My name is Webster Tarpley. I'm a contributing editor of Executive Intelligence Review. We're very pleased, above all, this afternoon to be able to present you with our special feature study entitled The Coming Fall of the House of Windsor. We feel that this is a kind of analysis that no other publication in the world would be capable of offering at this time. And we will hear in a moment from a number of the authors of this study. Now, you will notice that our account of the policies of the House of Windsor is in the form of an indictment for high crimes against humanity according to the Nuremberg Code. And the main charge is that Prince Philip Mountbatten, alias the Duke of Edinburgh, working together with the World Wildlife Fund, has over the past 33 years, approximately, engaged in a campaign of deliberate genocide against the nations and populations of Africa, especially sub-Saharan Africa. This campaign of genocide has been carried out under the banner of radical ecologism, that is to say, the lunatic contention that the main problems facing humanity are overpopulation and industrial pollution. And as we will hear, documented with quotes, these are principal ideological obsessions of Prince Philip himself. One of Philip's leading accessories in these crimes has been Prince Bernard of the Netherlands, of the House of Orange-Nassau. Now, Prince Philip has mobilized for the purpose of carrying out this genocide a continuing criminal enterprise, which includes such organizations as the Club of the Isles, the 1001 Club, and others, with the leadership made up of the British-centered European oligarchy. It also includes the World Wildlife Fund, as we will point out. Implicated also in these genocidal activities are companies and corporations in the orbit of the British Crown and the City of London, including such as Imperial Chemical Industries, Royal Dutch Shell, Rio Tinto Zinc, De Beers Consolidated Mines, the Anglo-American Corporation, Lonro, Unilever, the City of London banking establishment in general. There are also parts of the British government involved, including factions of British intelligence, and such organizations as Special Air Services. We also point to the role of Baroness Linda Chalker and the so-called Overseas Development Ministry of Great Britain. They're also implicated. Now, this network has most notably created a series of protected nature parks or wilderness areas across sub-Saharan Africa. We'll be showing you some of these in just a moment. These were built on the model of Lord Kitchener's and Lord Milner's Kruger National Park in South Africa. It is perhaps ironic, as we point out, that the World Wildlife Fund and its retainers have actually ended up slaughtering, for the purposes of profit and greed, the very animal species that they have taken money to protect. But this is, of course, only incidental to Prince Philip's plan, which is to treat people like these animals. Prince Philip's network has used the African nature parks as bases for guerrilla warfare, destabilization, revolution, terrorism, secret armies, paramilitary activities, and subversion. Our report catalogs numerous overt acts of this type. Most recently, most notably, the use of the nature parks along the border between Uganda and Rwanda by the British puppet Museveni, the president of Uganda, who has set into motion the invasion of Rwanda by sections of the Ugandan army calling themselves the Rwandan Patriotic Front. This operation involved Baroness Chalker and Museveni and has resulted in the deaths of almost 1 million persons in the past 2 years. But this is only a hint of what Prince Philip's policies would do to the world if they were to be fully realized and applied everywhere. In his introductory section to our report, Lyndon LaRouche points out that the net impact of Phillips' policy of depopulation and deindustrialization would be to lower the relative potential population density of our planet far below the level of the current population. That means that if Phillip prevails, world population could be expected to fall from the present level, just short of 6 billion people, to perhaps less than 1 billion, and that within the very short space of two generations. As LaRouche also notes, this kind of demographic implosion would administer a colossal shock to the collective immune system of all higher forms of life on this planet. And that might indeed result in the total extinction of human life by the close of the 21st century. And that would be the real end of history. This also might come about through the collapse of the biosphere, which is, of course, primarily sustained by human activity. So as we point out at numerous locations in the report, the indictment alleges crimes that are far worse than those of Hitler and the Nazis. Now, we have chosen Africa as our main case study to provide exhibits of Phillips' methods, but we also show that similar methods are being applied on other continents, notably Ibero-America and here in North America. And we point up Phillips' sponsorship, for example, of indigenous peoples for the purpose of stopping economic development over vast areas. We show that there is a plan to balkanize North America into petty states. That includes the planned breakup of Canada, which in turn would inject the bacillus of secessionism into the United States. So treason thus appears along with genocide in the bill of indictment. Now, although we accuse Prince Philip of a great deal, we do not accuse him of originality. The elements of Philip's policies are not new, but they have been around for many thousands of years. These are the typical characteristic features of oligarchy, of oligarchism, as these have been observed in every oligarchical society down from Babylon, Mesopotamia, the Greek cult of the Delphic Apollo, Venice, and down to our own time. Indeed, Philip and his networks represent the current form of an oligarchical faction which we can trace back in unbroken continuity to Babylon, Tyre, and earlier oligarchical regimes. So in this sense, Philip and company are simply displaying their nature as oligarchs. They may indeed be incapable of doing anything else. The oligarchical faction in history can be identified through its characteristic form of being a self-styled master race, an elite of aristocratic families who are obsessed with the idea that they are the lords of all creation. These families think that they have been placed above God's law and above natural law. The families think that they are placed in this position thanks to an epistemology which is based on a Stoic reading of Aristotle. The oligarchs insist that the human mind knows only the objects of sense and of sense certainty, and never thought objects or creative discovery as such. The oligarchs see man as an animal, deprived of any spark of creative reason. Oligarchical society operates through a wholly irrational principle of domination, with a tiny aristocratic elite commanding over a vast and degraded mass of slaves, serfs, helots, or subjects today, depending on what the traffic would bear. As a would-be master race, the oligarchs are inherently racist towards those who are not of Anglo-Saxon or Anglican background in this case. Because of the need to keep these degraded helots in their place, the oligarchy is hostile to the notion of an educated citizenry and cultivates hatred of science, technology, and progress, since these are seen as interfering with the need for domination. The oligarchical elite is monetarist from the word go. They seek wealth exclusively in the form of money amassed by the elite, today usually in the form of paper. The oligarchical elite is addicted to usury and related exorbitant interest rates on paper instruments like today's derivative securities. The bestialism of the oligarchy is expressed in international affairs in geopolitics, the methods of divide and conquer and the balance of power. And British meddling in these departments has brought us the two world wars of this century. The oligarchs necessarily converge on empire as a political system, with the British empire of only yesterday being the prime example. In the service of all these policies, the oligarchs fabricate myths, saying that the earth is overpopulated or over-industrialized. And of course, they hire scribblers and demagogues to propagate those views. The oligarchy does not have a monopoly on evil in the world, but the oligarchy has been the focus of evil, shall we say, in the macro realm, when it comes to wars, including world wars, famines, depressions, genocide, and the like. The oligarchy has generally been at work. Now, whenever control of a form of civilization falls into the hands of such an oligarchy, that civilization promptly turns onto the path leading to its own collapse. This is the kind of catastrophic collapse or breakdown crisis of civilization that is implied by Prince Philip's policies imposed on today's world. Now, today, the British monarchy, the House of Mountbatten-Windsor, is falling apart. This is related to the nature of current history. We are currently living through the culmination of a 500-year cycle of European and world history. Now, the basis for our present-day world civilization, including population, standards of living, and so forth, is to be found in the Italian Renaissance of the 15th century. The positive aspects of today's world have been possible thanks to the work of such figures as Nicholas Cusanus, Leonardo da Vinci, Raffaello Sanzio, and the other founders of modern science back in the Quattrocento. These figures, plus such later followers in the same tradition as Leibniz and Kepler, and their heirs, are the essence of modern science. This tradition is so fecund that it has produced more and better scientific progress during the past 500 years than in all previous human history. Our world is based on this Renaissance science, plus Dante's concept of the sovereign independent nation state as it was first realized in 15th century France by Louis the 11th. The United States is a later example of the same tradition. Now, these are the great achievements of modern civilization, but they have always been opposed by the oligarchy. In the period of the Renaissance, the main center of European oligarchism was Venice. Venice, the heiress of earlier oligarchical traditions coming from Delphi, Sparta, the Roman Empire, and the Byzantine Empire. So between about 1100 and 1600, Venice was the world capital of evil in this sense. The threat to Venice from Renaissance science and the Renaissance nation state was pointed up most dramatically in the 1509 War of the League of Cambrai. In that War of the League of Cambrai, the new nation states like France and Spain, plus the papacy and virtually every other country in Europe, combined in an alliance seeking to wipe out Venice. The Venetians were able to break up the League of Cambrai by corrupting the Pope, but the Venetian countermeasures in the wake of the War of the League of Cambrai have had the most profound impact on today's world. Those measures included the division of Europe by the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, leading to the Wars of Religion and the 30 Years' War. But the Venetians also concluded that in the era of large or even continental nation-states, they could no longer hope to conduct their geopolitical manipulations from the base of a tiny city-state in the marshes and lagoons of the northern Adriatic. So during these years, the Venetian oligarchy decided to transfer itself and its baggage, including its fondi, or family fortunes, its characteristic outlook and methods, to the north, to England. In short, the British Empire is the continuation of Venice. And the British, as distinct from the English or the Scots or the Irish, are transplanted Venetians. Gasparo Contarini, a Venetian of the early 1500s, sent his fellow Venetian oligarch Francesco Zorzi to the court of Henry VIII to advise King Henry on his divorce from Catherine of Aragon. And Zorzi stayed on at the English court as Henry VIII's resident sex counselor. One of the results of that activity of Zorzi as a sex counselor has been the Church of England, a very important British institution which is also in a deep crisis today. Now, Zorzi was already the big influence on Sir Philip Sidney and Edmund Spenser. And we find that British culture overall, since that time, has been assembled mainly through British plagiarism from Venetian originals. Examples. In the early 1600s, the boss of Venetian intelligence was Paolo Sarpi, who provided the idea content for Sir Francis Bacon, for John Milton, John Locke, David Hume, and the British empiricists. In the 1700s, the Venetian group around Antonio Conti and Gian Maria Ortes provided the idea content for the generation of Lord Shelburne, including Adam Smith, Jeremy Bentham, Thomas Malthus, Charles Darwin, for the utilitarians and the British philosophical radicals in general. So over the years, the Zorzi and Sarpi networks infested England with Venetian agents like Thomas Cromwell and the Cecil family. And with the coming of the Stuart dynasty, by about 1600, a full-fledged Venetian party had emerged in England. And by 1688, the so-called Glorious Revolution, this Venetian party had afflicted England with a full-blown oligarchical system, complete with a king who was not an absolute monarch on the French model, but rather a kind of Venetian doge. Between 1688 and 1815, Venetian intelligence played the indispensable role of helping the new British Empire to eliminate France as a global competitor and come close to world domination. During the 19th century, especially under Lord Palmerston, the British came close again to total world domination, but their attempt at universal monarchy was blocked by the alliance of Abraham Lincoln and Tsar Alexander II of Russia. During the 20th century, the British oligarchy has survived largely through a parasitizing of the economic and military resources of the United States through the so-called special relationship, which was begun almost 100 years ago under Theodore Roosevelt. Now, President Clinton has said that he intends to terminate this special relationship in favor of cooperation of the United States with Germany and with Russia. And this explains the great hostility shown to the president by the British oligarchy, one of the expressions of which has been the Whitewatergate affair. Now, today, the British and related oligarchs have come very close to wiping out the Christian humanism and science of the Renaissance. And this is the principal cause for the unfolding world breakdown crisis of civilization on this planet. The world market for derivative securities is centered in London, and it now amounts to upwards of $40 trillion, almost all of which has been created since the 1987 crash. Now, this derivative security market is now experiencing the seismic shocks, which are the precursors of a final panic crash. When the derivatives crash, they will bring about the disintegration of most of the current international financial system, including the IMF, the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the dollar, the other world currencies, most of the banking system. This will be a crash without precedent during the entire 500-year cycle that we're considering. To find a comparison, you must go back to the 1300s, to the fall of the Venetian-led Lombard banks, the Bardi, the Peruzzi, and others. This initiated the great crisis of the 14th century, which brought with it the Black Death and the Hundred Years' War, the events described in Barbara Tuchman's book, A Distant Mirror. Now, that was the crisis out of which the Renaissance emerged. Today, the 500-year cycle is ending again in a breakdown crisis, and we are threatened with a return of that distant horror, and we are threatened with its return right here in the United States. Now, I would stress that the programmatic forces associated with Executive Intelligence Review, especially our founder, Lyndon LaRouche, know what to do in order to create an economic recovery and indeed a new renaissance without having to go through another dark age. As LaRouche has put it, we know how to build a bridge from hell to purgatory. But the precondition for that is that the policies of Prince Philip and his clique, including their expression in the United Nations supranational world government, must go. Now that brings us to my final point, the dynastic crisis of the House of Hanover or of Windsor or Hanover-Battenberg or Mountbatten-Windsor, as it may be called. Now historically, these people have been judged and found wanting. And the handwriting is not just in the London tabloids, it's on the wall for all to see. Georg Ludwig of the Welfen or Guelph House of Hanover started off as George I of England under the auspices of that Venetian patrician Antonio Conti at the time of Conti's Newton operation. This original stock was not promising. A bit later came George III, and as our founding fathers here in the United States knew, George III was mad as a hatter. Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha produced a brood of princelings with Queen Victoria, but there was still no improvement. Edward VIII was too much a friend of Hitler to stay on the throne, so the oligarchy decided that he had to abdicate, and soon he was gone with the Windsors. The Battenbergs, or Mountbattens, arriving on the scene during this century, have not helped either. Lord Louis Mountbatten and his wife Edwina, that ménage that was known as the Dickie and Edwina show, distinguished itself only through antics that would have made Casanova blush. And Uncle Dickie, I'm afraid, has been the greatest single influence on Prince Charles. Now the issue is, if a prince who says that he talks to plants, not only that he talks to plants, but that they answer him, is qualified to be sovereign of the United Kingdom and head of the Church of England. According to the signals we've observed coming from over there, the British establishment, the oligarchy itself, seems to be saying that the current line of royals cannot be allowed to go on. So the result is likely to be a change of dynasty or an extinction of the monarchy itself. After the First World War, and even more after the Second World War, when so many royal houses had been expropriated, it used to be said that there were five unshakable pillars of monarchy. There were five kings that counted: hearts, diamonds, clubs, and spades, and England. Today it looks like the English monarchy may also be gone with the Windsors. Now, as Friedrich Schiller once observed, world history is the world court. What we would now like to present to you is a more detailed exposition of the specific points in this indictment, which we are submitting to the court of world public opinion. Let me now give the floor to Jeff Steinberg.
The copy of the EIR that I presume all of you now have in your hands was the immediate result of work that has taken place over a period of the last 7 months involving dozens of researchers, EIR researchers, a number of people who've collaborated with us on this effort, working on every continent on Earth. And in the course of this effort, we found that in order to actually come to an understanding of the actual nature of the strategic crisis of the day, and particularly the role of Prince Philip and the World Wildlife Fund and other allied agencies in this effort, it was first necessary to come to grips with and eventually debunk four rather significant myths which have served to blind the vast majority of human beings from understanding the true nature of the political crisis that we've been increasingly falling in throughout the course of the 20th century. The first of the myths that hopefully this special report and a series of follow-on articles that will be published in the next several issues of the EIR makes clear as a myth, is the notion that the British monarchy is somehow or other a powerless and irrelevant force in world affairs. The idea that the Queen herself is little more than an empty vessel sitting underneath a seemingly endless sequence of funny-looking hats, or that Prince Philip is somehow or other just simply her royal consort and a man more known for his philandering than his politics. The idea that the entire House of Windsor and the extended European monarchy are essentially all pomp and no circumstance. The second derivative myth is the idea that the political lack of power of the British House of Windsor is complemented by the fact that they have absolutely no financial or economic power. And this in part derives from the fact that the wealth of the House of Windsor is largely secretive, and very little is known about even the normal corporate holdings, a fact that's facilitated by the fact that the Windsors don't pay taxes. The third myth, which one is forced to confront with in even just beginning to look at Prince Philip in his own words, in coming to understand what the philosophical and policy content is of the House of Windsor, is the idea that somehow this concept of the genocide of World War II can never happen again. This idea of the myth of never again. In fact, the organizational structure that Prince Philip personally is in charge of represents nothing less than a full reconstituting on an even more vast scale of the Allgemeine SS that was one of the arms of the Hitler genocide during World War II. There were three SS organizations, just to give people a brief explanation of this particular point. There was the military organization called the Waffen-SS, which is probably most familiar to people. There was the Reiter-SS, which was the sort of knights of the Nazi regime, principally made up of princes and royalty of the Germanic area, who were also among the enthusiastic supporters of Hitler. But there was a far more important entity called the Allgemeine SS, which included those princes, but also included leading figures from within the industrial and financial community. And we're going to find that some of these people who were active figures in this Allgemeine SS organization during World War II were instrumental in reconstituting that same apparatus following the war under the banner of ecologism and under a number of different corporate entities. The fourth myth is the idea that somehow or other all power in the world rests in some named and identifiable front organization. And you very often find among populists here in the United States a debate over whether or not the true center of world power is in the Bilderberg Society or the Trilateral Commission or the Council on Foreign Relations or the United Nations Organization. When one begins to grasp the concept of oligarchism, as Webster Tarpley presented it in brief just before me, it should become almost self-evident that no entity that has a name and a board of directors and a formal list of assets and members would conceivably be entrusted with the actual concentration of power that we're talking about here. So, to begin with, in debunking some of these myths, we undertook a top-down effort to actually look at the structure and power and financial base of the European-centered oligarchical families that 100 years ago vested in the House of Windsor the responsibility for being the primer inter pares, the first among equals, the sort of CEO and chief operations officers of the combined political and financial power of these European houses. And what I'd like to do is actually start with slide number one to go through some of the documentation of this. This is a map of the world which simply indicates in the darkened areas the nations of the British Commonwealth. There are all told 50 member countries in the British Commonwealth, and through various means and subterfuges, the House of Windsor, Queen Elizabeth II, Prince Philip, and the apparatus that surrounds that are in effect the de facto sovereigns over this entire territory. It's a mistake to think of Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip as simply being the sovereigns over this small little shipwrecked entity out here in the edge of the Atlantic called the British Isles. Among the 50 countries of the British Commonwealth, Queen Elizabeth II is the formal sovereign in 17 of those countries. And while these are not in many cases the largest of the nations, if one looks at the importance of the offshore financial centers, such as the British sovereign islands in the Caribbean, Hong Kong, and similar locations, one begins to see that within the realm of the international illegal black market and drug apparatus, this is an absolutely indispensable part of the capability. Let's now switch over to the first table. Webster Tarpley mentioned earlier that Queen Elizabeth II of Great Britain is a descendant of the House of Windsor, which took the name Windsor in the early years of the 20th century, but which has been on the sovereign throne of England since the beginning of the 18th century. However, to begin to actually understand what we're talking about here, it's important to actually take in, at least briefly, and I would urge people to look this chart over more carefully, it's included in the EIR issue that you all have, to consider the extended family, the cousinhood, if you will, of intermarried royal houses which today maintain the thrones in a number of European countries, Scandinavia, England, Greece, Spain. There are now, in the aftermath of the fall of the Iron Curtain, efforts underway to reestablish monarchical lines of succession on the sovereign thrones of places like the former Yugoslavia, like Russia itself. And so the point is that we're not simply here discussing Great Britain, England, the House of Windsor. We're talking about an interlocking family directorate which maintains claims and real estate titles over many parts of the world and which uses the sovereign authority over dozens of governments around the world as an integral part of their power base. Now, while the combined power and financial assets of this extended royal family tree do not reside in any single formal organization which is registered with some Secretary of State's office, there is nevertheless an informal name which is given to the extended apparatus which Elizabeth and Philip at the present time are the reigning CEO and chief operations officers over. Among some of the people involved in this, the name that's frequently used is the Club of the Isles. We're talking about the British royal household, the Dutch royal household, some of the Scandinavian houses, Greece, Spain, and some of the others. And the actual assets, combined financial power of these royal households and some of their associated princely families has been roughly estimated in present dollar terms, direct control, direct ownership over one and perhaps pushing $2 trillion. Since much of this combined wealth takes the form of shares in various crown authorized joint stock company ventures modeled on the old British and Dutch East India companies, the actual resources, material resources, at the disposal of this combined apparatus are somewhere in the vicinity, again estimated because of the degree of secrecy involved here, estimated at within the range of approximately $10 trillion in real assets, much of it real estate, much of it ownership through intermediaries over the majority shares in major corporations like Rio Tinto Zinc, Unilever, Royal Dutch Shell, British Petroleum, the Anglo-American Corporation, Imperial Chemical Industry. If you look at the concentration of raw material control exerted by this combine of companies, you begin to get at least the first approximation of the financial and political clout that we're talking about here. And unlike the current American notions of what it means to be a stockholder in a corporation, these companies operate off of the old Venetian party methods, which were reflected in the efforts of the British East India Company in the 18th and 19th centuries, and ownership also constitutes tight political control, such that if one were to look at the events of the last decade or so and contemplate things like the 8-year war between Iran and Iraq, the more recent war against Iraq, some of the wars that have been manipulated throughout the continent of Africa. Through these means, not only has this apparatus exerted geopolitical control and manipulation, overreaching the sovereignty of nation states to exert their control, but in every one of these ventures, they have always made it a point of using the methods of insider trading to profiteer to the maximum extent off of the misery of billions of human beings. This is just a very small segment of what we have called Prince Philip's corporate SS. And as we begin in a moment to discuss the specific role of the World Wildlife Fund, now known as the Worldwide Fund for Nature, you'll see that branched around this institution and branched around the British monarchy are a highly interfaced network of banks, raw material cartels, and other corporate entities that constitute one single concentration of political and financial power. One of the best examples that is worth considering here is if you look under Barclays Bank PLC, Sir Martin Wakefield Jacob, who retired a year or so ago as the chairman, one of the chairmen of Barclays Bank, the same Sir Martin Wakefield Jacob is on the Bank of England, sits on the board of directors of the Rio Tinto Zinc Corporation, which has strong interfaces with Imperial Chemical and a number of these other entities. Jacob is also on the board of the Telegraph PLC, which is one of the Crown's most important propaganda arms, not only owning the Telegraph papers in England, but being part of the Hollinger Corporation, which owns the Jerusalem Post, which owns most of the financial press in the English-speaking world, and owns well over 100 newspapers in the United States alone. So this is, in effect, a part of the integrated propaganda apparatus that goes along with all of these things. The Anglo-American Corporation, De Beers Mining, and De Beers Centenary AG are companies that Al Douglas will probably say a little bit more about, but suffice it to say that those are, along with Lonro, the principal entities that are the form through which this apparatus exerts its control over the continent of Africa on behalf of a systematic policy of genocide. This is a rough approximation of the military command structure, and the point here is to just convey a certain overall sense of the invisible command structure through which the House of Windsor exerts its political and financial control on behalf of a very specific policy outlook. And I think it's worth looking at this chart from the standpoint of a certain timeline as well. We've already seen that the entity known as the Club of the Isles, this combined interlocking series of royal households and the combined wealth that they exert, has been around for a long period of time. Its formal existence probably dating back 100 years. For a century, the only people who talked about ecology and the concern about nature and about endangered species were people who were immediately and blatantly associated with the British royal household and with similar royal households in other countries of Europe. Entities like the Royal Geographical Society, the Zoological Society of London, were founded well over 100 years ago. Groups like the Fauna and Flora Preservation Society, which formerly was known as the Preservation Society of the Empire, have been around since the turn of the century. At the close of the Second World War, a second phase was opened up, which in part was posed by the problem that the public exposure of the genocide by the Hitler regime during World War II gave the pet pseudoscience of the British royal household, the pseudoscience of eugenics, a bad name, because the practices of World War II demonstrated what the actual motives were of the eugenics movement, the culling of the human herd in order to perpetuate the power of this oligarchy. So at the close of World War II, the same exact people who were involved in perpetrating the fraud, the racial fraud of eugenics, set up a series of new organizations aimed at pursuing the identical policies, but simply under a slightly more benign public relations title, nature conservation. So the Nature Conservancy was set up at the end of the Second World War. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature was set up at the same time frame, and you'll see that this was set up on the basis of a constitution that was formally drafted by the British Foreign Office. The United Nations Organization in particular, through UNESCO, which was founded and headed by Julian Huxley, a leading figure founding the IUCN, and one of the people who for decades had been the head of the eugenics movement inside England. So these organizations were set up during the period immediately following the close of World War II to revive the eugenics movement under the name of Nature Conservancy. In the early 1960s, as a cornerstone of Britain's phony decolonization policy, during the period of the Winds of Change, the World Wildlife Fund was founded specifically to be the instrumentality through which the House of Windsor and Great Britain would reassert in even more brutal form its imperial control over parts of the world like Africa. And so the World Wildlife Fund was founded in 1961, and the details of the WWF story in Africa will be told in just a few minutes by Al Douglas. Suffice it to say that the World Wildlife Fund was initially founded by two men, Prince Philip, the royal consort of Queen Elizabeth II, and Prince Bernhard, the royal consort of the Queen of the Netherlands. Now, whereas Prince Philip thinks like a Nazi, Prince Bernhard had the honor, quote unquote, of having had the formal credentials of being a leading figure within the Nazi Party. He was recruited to the Nazi Party as a young student at the University of Berlin in the early 1930s, was assigned to a critical intelligence responsibility as the intelligence officer assigned to the Egay-Farben chemical cartel, which produced the gas that was used in the Nazi gas chambers. Parenthetically, throughout the Second World War, the alliance between Egay-Farben and the imperial chemical industry of England was never broken. And so we have Prince Philip and Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands jointly founding the WWF and running that organization to this day as one of the important uniformed divisions of the overall Prince Philip's Allgemeine SS. Now, in the late 1960s, it was still the case that the vast majority of people who favored radical environmentalism and some of these other causes that today we come to think of as having a certain mass base of support were nevertheless simply oligarchs, plain and simple. By the late 1960s, through the advent of the drug, rock, sex counterculture, which was, if nothing else, an assault on reason, an attack on any kind of semblance of science. By the late 1960s, suddenly there was a large number of people who, in between drug stupors, were susceptible to some of the quack science of this oligarchical apparatus. And as the result of that, we find in the late 1960s the founding of organizations like Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, Survival International, which advocated in the most ruthless terms a return to primitivism, in effect the creation of human zoos in many different parts of the planet. And in turn, in the late 1970s, as it became somewhat of an embarrassment that every one of these organizations had been publicly and knowingly funded directly from the inner circles of Prince Philip through the WWF and the 1001 Club, which I'll get into in a minute, suddenly these groups themselves began spinning off even more violent eco-terrorist organizations, which operate with abandon in many parts of the world today. And this is another element of the capability that is tightly deployed top-down through this structure that we're talking about here. This is a profile of the operations of the World Wildlife Fund. This is the kind of map that one can envision in the headquarters of the World Wildlife Fund and IUCN in Gland, Switzerland. You see that much of Africa, much of South America, almost the entirety of North America, all of Europe, and significant parts of Asia are areas that have been identified as prime targets of the WWF, either as locations where they have formal national organizations or areas where they have established operational bases. Particularly, we'll see the extensive activities in Eastern Africa. This is just a brief profile of some of the things that you saw on the previous map. The kinds of people who presently sit on the International Advisory Council, the number of countries that now have either formal affiliation with the WWF or have program offices. Now, in 1971, Prince Philip and Prince Bernhard decided that it was necessary to upgrade the financial foundations of the WWF. And working off of Prince Bernhard's Rolodex, a group of several thousand people were contacted and invited to become founding chartered members of an entity called the 1001 Club, which was specifically called a nature trust. And these were people who were, in many instances, fabulously wealthy, but were chosen principally because of their allegiance and affiliation to the outlook of Prince Philip and Prince Bernhard. And these are just, by breakdown of countries, an indication of where the 1001 Club membership is based. Among the kinds of people that we saw in the membership ranks of the club were people who typified during the World War II period membership in the Allgemeine SS. You've got virtually every living member of the Rothschild family. You have representatives of the major international British and Dutch oil companies, all of the major City of London banks, the members of every princely family of Europe, a handful, a small scattering of African leaders, government officials, who have been, in effect, recruited and co-opted into this apparatus. But interestingly, among the membership in the 1001 Club, a number of other kinds of people stand out because their international reputations today are those of international rogues, gangsters, and killers. For example, Robert Vesco, who's now a fugitive from justice in the United States, was a recently indicted member of the Medellin cocaine cartel, was one of the founding members by invitation of the 1001 Club. Similarly, Tibor Rosenbaum, who was one of the principal money launderers for the Meyer Lansky International Crime Syndicate in Switzerland, was also a principal figure within the 1001 Club and one of the early invited members. The Cisneros family in Venezuela, which has been recently exposed for its involvement and association with people in the international drug money laundering business and other crimes, also show up on the list. So it's a unsavory as well as well-connected group of people. And this, in a certain sense, is a part of the organized directorate over this entire international genocidal eugenics nature conservation movement today. Now, I just want to finish up by making one final observation, because in effect, what we attempted to pull together in this initial EIR study was, as Webster Tarpley indicated at the beginning, a literal bill of indictment, a criminal bill of indictment. If one can envision a reconvening of the Nuremberg tribunals that took place at the end of World War II, the people who we identify in this report would all be in the docket for crimes against humanity that make the crimes of the Nazi regime of World War II seem small in comparison. What's more, Prince Philip has made it a point repeatedly of flaunting his commitment to genocide and has written books, articles, has given interviews with major international news organizations in which he has made his views about the importance of culling the human species increasingly more and more well known. The concept for the present day that has been adopted by Prince Philip, by the WWF apparatus, for quote unquote saving the oligarchical system at this moment of profound breakdown crisis, is to carry out genocide against practically 80% of the world's population. The objective of the WWF and the Club of the Isles and this apparatus that we're talking about here is to reduce the population of the world to below 1 billion people over the next 2 to 3 generations, which means a level of population genocide on a global scale that even surpasses the genocide in Africa in recent years. Prince Philip is unabashed about this, and as he told reporters for the German news agency DPA in a published interview in August 1988, quote, "In the event that I am reincarnated," and I can assure you that he believes in reincarnation, "I would like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve overpopulation." Now, one might speculate that this was an offhand comment made perhaps under a drug or alcohol stupor or a moment of particular rage or sexual frustration, but indeed, repeatedly in recent years, Prince Philip has repeated this identical formulation. In one instance, in the foreword to a book that he wrote, in which he had ample opportunity to do final editing and rethink the words that were going to be attributed to him. In the foreword to his 1986 autobiographical confessions called If I Were an Animal, Prince Philip said, and I quote, "I just wonder what it would be like to be reincarnated in an animal whose species had been so reduced in numbers that it was in danger of extinction. What would be its feelings towards the human species whose population explosion had denied it somewhere to exist? I must confess that I am tempted to ask for reincarnation as a particularly deadly virus." Now, the image of culling the human herd has been something that's been on Philip's mind for a long time. In another one of his published works called Down to Earth, published in 1988, he said, quote, "I don't claim to have any special interest in natural history, but as a boy, I was made aware of the annual fluctuations in the number of game animals and the need to adjust the cull to the size of the surplus population." Prince Philip's concept is to apply the same methods, the culling through genocide of the entire surplus population of human beings, and we will now hear from Al Douglas to get some sort of an idea of one of the most graphic and ongoing aspects of implementation of the Prince Philip and WWF design. Thank you.